Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome to Blog Talk Radio, The Cosmic Citizen. This is Paula Thompson. It's a beautiful day, and I'm on my way to Pueblo, Colorado. And Larry Watkins. Larry, are you there?
I'm here, and we have a 603 on as well.
Okay, is that should be Andre. Is that Andre?
I don't know.
Well, you know, as you know, folks, we're having Our esteemed friend and regular guest, Chris Halverson, calling in today, and he's going to be discussing eugenics with us. And while we're waiting, I guess Andre and Chris haven't called in yet, so be sure and patch them through right when they call, Larry. But I just want to say that the Urantia book often gives us the unsung heroes of Urantia, the people who worked behind the scenes and did so much for our planet and for our evolution to help us along. And Larry, you're one of those unsung heroes.
Well, thank you.
And Chris Halverson is another one who, you know, every Friday night he goes and sets up study group in Boulder, and he brings boxes of tea and goodies, and he sets up a table with he and Katie or his wife Katie are dedicated to having that class every Friday night. They serve in myriad ways, just as you do, Larry. So I'm really appreciative of all of the people who are always willing to work behind the scenes, the unsung hero. So is no Chris yet, huh?
No, well, Chris, we have a 603 area code.
Well, try it. Patch it through and see what happens.
The mic is open. Hello, 603. Who's there?
Hi, Larry and Paul. This is Lewis, and I'm just listening right now because my internet.
Oh, okay, Lewis. Housing.
Yeah. I didn't know I would get through because I didn't press 1. I thought I was just listening.
Well, that's okay. We'll mute your mic so that you don't have to worry about making noise.
Okay, but Larry, if I do want to comment later, I should press 1. Is that it?
What's that?
I say if I do want to comment later, I can press 1 and get in.
Oh, okay. Either that or put a note on the chat room discussion and we'll unmute your mic.
Okay, but you can mute it right now.
Okay, I will. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, and we should remind folks, if you do want to call in, the number to call in is 646-716-8158, and it's typically listed right on the board there. You can see it if you tuned in to the internet page. So today we're going to be talking about eugenics, and you know the Urantia book has a great deal to say about our genetic makeup as human beings and the benefit and detriment of that, and that it's really humanity's responsibility to some degree or another, and at some point to make sure that they eliminate negative genes from the gene pool, genes that are debilitating and cause disease. And it's very controversial, I think, because, and Andre wanted to do this series on controversy.
And Andre's here now.
Oh, Andre's here. Hi, Andre.
I am. You know what? I got to tell you something really funny, you guys. I had a dream that I was going to be late for the show, and I thought, no, I can't do that. You know, but I ended up being late. So some dreams should not come true. Except in this dream, I was half. Except you know what? In this dream, I was half an hour late. So not quite.
Oh well, good.
But we
thank
do
God.
Chris, we do have Chris Halverson with us. Are you there, Chris?
I'm here. Yes.
Good. Excellent. Excellent. Thank you so much for bearing with me, Paula. Are you on the road, by the way, Paula? Are you on the road?
Yeah, we're headed towards Monument, and it just got cloudy down this way.
I'm asking because you usually read wonderful. You usually do such a good job of reading quotes from the book, and today I'm going to have Chris read because it's going to be unless you're not driving. I don't know if you can read in the car.
No, and you know, really, I have to say that the reason that I can find quotes so quickly is because I've become an expert at using folio views.
Right, there you go. Yeah, but you just do such a good, I'm just saying you just do such a good job reading. That's all I'm saying.
Thanks, Andre.
So, anyway, folks, we are going to talk about another controversial topic today. Controversy is my middle name. And we're going to be talking about eugenics. And the word eugenics only appears one time in the Urantia book. It appears in one of the adjuster papers in the section on the inner life, and it says that people should be that you know our society is in danger when youth engage in only sensory professions like material pursuits, and they should be studying things like philosophy, religion, cosmology, eugenics. Just kind of happens to go there right by itself, you know. And it's a politically incorrect term these days, but the actual meaning of the term, it just means good birth. That's really what it means. And
what does it mean, Andre?
It means good birth.
I'd like to speak to that a little bit, too, here,
okay.
To start right up front. But go ahead and finish your
talk. I was just going to say, I want you to talk about that. I want to introduce our guest again, Chris Halverson. Chris Halverson is a noted scholar of the Urantia book. He's been reading the book steadily since 1990. He is... He's got a great study group in Boulder, he's just someone who's just really well known in the community, well respected. We've had him on twice before, and so Chris, welcome back to our show.
I think it's actually three times before, but yes, thank you. Glad to be here.
Yes. And I want to so the word eugenics, as I said, means good birth. That's what it means. Talk a little bit about that, Chris, and what that's about.
Okay, let's drop back just a tad, and I mean definitely. When you're dealing with a subject like eugenics, the first thing that we need to have right up front is the understanding that words have true meanings. Now, when you go to the dictionary, you'll find definitions of words. That isn't the meaning of the word. Those are just definitions attached to that word. And if you take a word is related to an area where there's a high degree of ignorance in current human understanding, for instance, the word truth or the word spirit, you may find that almost all of the definitions attached to those words are false and not true. And let's take a specific example. If you limit your understanding of the idea of the fatherhood of God to the most debased individual who's ever fathered a child, then you have no relationship to the truth. in your understanding of the word father. The word eugenics is a very similar word, and that we need to have a clearer sense of what it is. We can't have a discussion about this if that word is defined by the most debased and ignorant thoughts of human history.
Wow, that's a good point.
So let me just so that listeners may know what we're talking about. Some listeners may not even know what we're about to discuss here, okay? Because some listeners may be familiar with some of the controversial passages in the Urantia book, which we can read a little later, which talk about how certain people shouldn't be reproducing, and it talks about the antisocial and inferior stock and all these different words that are today, again, considered very politically correct. So historically, historically, at least in America, these kinds of principles or concepts have been associated with the science, or some would say pseudoscience, of eugenics. So let's talk again about the word eugenics and the word good birth and what that means.
So let's draw back. Now, literally, etymologically, the word eugenic, let's take the root there, the word eugenic, you're close. I mean, more precisely, it means well-born. It's very important, for instance, right up front, to not confuse well and good.
Okay.
This is an area where humans don't appreciate the distinction. The word good is a spiritual word. Good and bad are related to spirit. We're not talking about that. We're talking about well and ill. We're talking about the relationship to the cosmos, the relationship to the supreme. And so you have eugenic, well-born, and dysgenic, ill-born. And certainly in humans' initial thinking about those ideas, it's in that general domain of heredity. You know, you have a lot of experience with that throughout human history with animal husbandry or even agriculture. But in the wake of modern scientific discoveries, you know, the concept of eugenic has gone to a much more specific understanding. We now know about DNA. We know about genetics. And so, a more specific understanding of eugenics is well genetics, you know, and then in opposition to ill genetics. For instance, we now appreciate that there are some diseases that are genetic diseases. Okay, that we know it's related to DNA.
Mm-hmm.
Well, by definition, if you appreciate that there is such a thing as genetic disease, disease is not about wellness. It's about being ill. So by definition, you know, you're talking about the recognition of ill genetics, dysgenic. And you're thinking, you know, if I had a better understanding of DNA, how this all hangs together, how the whole system, biologic system, hangs together, I could appreciate well genetics, and I could use genetic engineering to right an ill. And let's take a specific example of me. I'll use myself as an example. My dad was diabetic. I'm not diabetic, but I possess that
genetic tendency,
ill character in my DNA, you know, recessively. I can pass that on. I mean, we know that's an ill character. You know, having diabetes is not wellness. At some point, we're going to understand the DNA to the point where we can fix that defect in DNA. we can make the genetics well.
Okay,
that's
I'm
eugenics.
That. I'm glad you said that, Chris, because...
Excuse me, Andre, the people on the chat room board are asking that you speak up a bit.
Me?
Or Andre.
Oh, Andre.
I'm sorry. Okay, I'm sorry.
Chris,
I can hear.
You're
I can
coming
hear.
Through just fine.
It's actually better. I had the phone away from my mouth a little bit. Okay, Chris, let's get back to this concept of because when you said that you're not diabetic, but you have the character, you carry it recessively, so maybe you'll be able to pass that on, okay, in your genes. Now, some readers I know of the book, I think, have this idea that somehow the Celestials would just say, well, then if you have that condition, then you shouldn't be allowed to reproduce, period. Just that simple. It's black and white. But you said you talked about fixing the genetic defect. So I'm assuming, correct me if I'm wrong, that curtailing reproduction is not the only alternative here, that there are other approaches and ways that this can be managed. I mean, people talk about gene therapy and things like that. I guess what I'm trying to get to is, I want to know what, since these passages in the book are so controversial, I want to make sure we understand what the authors are really saying and not just, you know, interpreting the book by the baggage that we bring to it.
Right.
And I would like to add something too here, and that is that there is more than one kind of genetic abnormality that I think the authors of the Urantia book are more concerned with the antisocial behaviors, or the behaviors of the genetic tendencies maybe towards extreme antisocial behavior like a serial killer or criminal types that commit violent crimes against humanity. And I think that is important to point out too. It's not just about well-being, as Chris had said, you know, your physical well-being. It's also about your spiritual well-being. And I think that research has proven that genetics has a great deal to do with your whole makeup, the makeup of your whole person.
Let's flesh that out a little bit, because you're on, you know, on a major point there. The whole concept of selective reproduction, you know, is extensively discussed in the Revelation. And it has this broad perspective. It starts all the way back in the dispensation of the planetary prince, where the first thing that's addressed is just the basic biologic fitness. So in that very early stage where you're starting with primitive man, you know, very primitive man, the first thing that's addressed is just that basic biologic aspect of the situation. You're not going to deal with any of the higher things yet. First things first. And so over the span of about 500,000 years, the planetary prince and his staff manage this issue of genetic wellness, you know, in relation to the basic biologic issues, and it's very important to understand when you talk about selective reproduction, you're not talking about management by fiat. You're not talking about inserting yourself in there and just turning a knob and fixing something. You're talking about allowing the system to be fully engageable by the Supreme, so that over the span of 500,000 years, the Supreme can manifest through evolving man in regard to this basic biologic aspect and have all those issues taken care of, essentially, before Adam and Eve arrive.
Now, are you describing the Supreme in terms of the over-control of evolution? Could you define what you mean by Supreme for
what I mean by that? What I mean by that is we don't really evolve. We are evolved. Biologic phenomena are not self-evolving.
Yeah.
They are evolved by God the Mother, by the Supreme. The Supreme is the over-controller of evolution. It's the hand that guides it forward as a whole towards the purpose of the finite. And so initially, that hand is being given the full opportunity to engage this issue of the biology. You don't go in and say, well, here is the cream of the crop, let's just eliminate everyone else. That's not the way the Supreme works. You're actually short-circuiting the Supreme. The Supreme spans the whole breadth. You just manage the distribution of the different types and then allow evolution. In this case, it takes 500,000 years, you know, usually on average, for that to play out. It's a very patient process for the Supreme to engage that.
Well,
now,
I'm glad you bring this up, Chris, because I think what happens, and again, I want to go back to this, because this is something I want to address extensively throughout the show. One of the things that some readers will do is they'll read some of these controversial passages about the inferior stock, or, and they'll say, and they'll take this slash and burn approach to eugenics. We got to do this now. It's a crisis. We got to get rid of these undesirables now. We got to do this. And what you're sounds like what you're
that's
saying.
That's the point I'm trying to make.
Yeah, that's
nowhere.
That's not what they're suggesting. Right. First of all, the book also says that things work better by evolution rather than revolution.
Well, I mean, revolution, you know, is rebellion. So, yeah, it probably doesn't work as well. You know, you're talking about always being synchronized with the Supreme. The wise planetary administrators manage things in great humility, where they're always, you know, looking at the signs of the times, looking at the state of the Supreme, and managing relative to that, so that the system can sync up with the Supreme as best as possible. Rebellion is assuming that you don't need the Supreme, you don't need the finite upholder, that we're self-actualizing, and you can just perfect things by fiat.
And that's what you mean when you say short circuit, and in fact, you really couldn't short-circuit the Supreme. You just will render whatever you're trying to do ineffective.
You'll disconnect and fail is all you'll do.
Right.
So with the best of intention.
Let me say this back to you, and you tell me if I'm on the right track. What you're suggesting is in the Supreme, then we become partners with that, and we try to patiently and gently guide ourselves or our genetics, our genetic makeup in the right direction without trying to do anything radical, revolutionary.
Right.
We're just identifying, and which is happening right now with genetic research, we're identifying renegade genes, let's say, and we're trying to eliminate them from the gene pool.
Yeah, and we face a very difficult problem because, like I'm, you know, the story I'm laying out here, initially, just that basic biologic component is handled during the dispensation of the planetary prince. Okay, and then that's followed by the dispensation of Adam and Eve. And what happens there is they are taking it the next step. We're during that, you know, roughly 25,000 years of that dispensation, they're not only continuing the management of these basic biologic issues, but specifically blending the races at the same time. And when you blend the races, there's new issues that come into play that need to be managed so that progressive blend is synchronized with the Supreme, and the Supreme's hand can actualize all the latent potentials of that blending. But by the time you get to the end of the Adamic dispensation, so you should have one race, and all of the basic biologic issues have been defects have been eliminated.
So you've eliminated disease or dis-ease.
Yeah, by and large, all of the real fundamental biologic issues have been addressed. Okay, we have none of that right now, or almost none of it. We're in a very difficult situation where 525,000 years of evolution has been thwarted because the rebellion disengaged us from the hand of the Supreme.
Wow.
And that includes the Adamic default.
Right.
Okay. Now let me ask you this. It's funny you should say this because they were 525,000 years behind. That's pretty amazing. wow. Now let me ask you this, because one of the things we talked about last week when we spoke on world government on the show with Byron Bilitsos is the book does say that sometimes, even though evolution is normally a slow process, sometimes you have sudden things that happen suddenly. Like the appearance of Jesus Christ, Michael, okay, or even you might even argue the appearance of the Iran book. That revelation is sort of this thing that periodically comes in and
right, there's two different types of suddenlies. There's the
assertion
of the Father hand, which is obviously a suddenly, that's a revelation. But then there's also suddenlies in evolution. The hand of the mother also has suddenlies.
The reason I ask is, I see what you're saying. Okay, the reason I ask is, even though we're 525,000 years behind. Do you see the possibility of maybe something sudden happening in order to? I mean, the book says we're not going to have another Adam and Eve. It does say that. So and it says no material son and daughter will come back. So it's going to be up to us to control. So actually, maybe I'm answering my own question. I don't think we're going to have some superhuman intervention in this area.
And they also say that you're not going to get any. Suddenly of evolution in terms of upstep of our basic biologic character welling up out of our biology. No new man is going to suddenly appear. In terms of the basic biologic facts, they're fixed. The starting point has been established. So, to a large degree, we need to rely on genetic engineering. They point out, when you get into the Light and Life paper, that it's always, even on a completely normal world, this is always a twofold process. In all those early stages, you have... this gentle management and the hand of the Supreme evolving things forward, and then in comes the Adamic upliftment that fosters the ability of the Supreme to engage the system and bring it to its essentially its biologic completion. But that has its limits. That whole even with the Adamic upliftment that only takes you so far. As you're getting forward into, especially when you get into the post-Bestowal Son Age and the Trinity Teacher Son Ages, more and more you have an approaching completeness of scientific knowledge. And I even have the quote here right in front of me. They're talking about in the post-Bestowal Age, they say disease has been practically mastered through the high resistant qualities of the Adamic strains, so that's that first part, and by the intelligent and worldwide application of the discoveries of the physical sciences of preceding ages.
So this is a partnership, then, between revelation and evolution, if you will.
Yeah, and we now know what the discoveries of the physical sciences, the key thing here, it's genetics,
mm-hmm.
the complete understanding of DNA, how it works. And not only in just that basic biologic domain, which is handled, like I said, during the Prince's dispensation and Adam and Eve's dispensation, but then the next dispensation with the Magisterial Son, that is continuing this selective reproduction process, but now addressing those very basic mindal issues, because
I want to clarify. You just mentioned the word dispensation for our listeners that don't know what you're talking about. The Urantia book describes dispensations of evolution, and they are characterized by certain achievements in human evolution. So I just want to make that basic definition.
And in a normal world. You have one or more magisterial sons, and that follow Adam and Eve, And that runs in the 25,000 to 50,000 year range again. So again, a normal world, this is a very long process, very patient process of dealing with all the basic issues.
And
so that when
isn't
you get,
it true?
Yeah.
Isn't it true that you only get, a normal world only gets one biological facility?
Uplifting pair, yeah.
Right. So yeah. The of all the things that ever happened to our world that set us behind, I mean, the Lucifer Rebellion was just dreadful. But losing Adam and Eve, the Adamic default, I think, was the worst thing.
Right, because they could have. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, no, I was just going to say, because not only did we lose their that all-important biological uplift, we also lost their guidance. And I know you probably remember this quote, Chris. They say, you know, in discussing this whole issue, they say one of the problems is that you really don't have anybody on your planet wise enough, and I, of course I'm paraphrasing, but there's no wise administrators to help you make these difficult decisions about genetics.
Right. What is that? What it actually says, Paul, is that, and I pretty much memorized it. It's in the paper on the planetary atoms, and it basically says that one problem with such radical experiments on your world is the absence of competent judges to determine the biologic fitness or unfitness of the individuals of your world races.
Gee,
so But I guess what I was getting at earlier, though, Chris, is, and I'm sorry, I want to let you finish what you had to say, Paul. I just
No. And I didn't mean to interrupt you, Chris, either, because I know you're.
Yeah. Let me just tack before you go on, Andre. Just to tack on that thought that, losing the planetary prince and his staff is one thing, but you know, Adam and Eve could have picked up their role and dealt with both issues, both the basic biology and the racial biology, you know, and blending, so that, you know, they could have led us all the way to the normal endpoint of one race with all of the basic biologic issues taken care of, so that you have an integrous stock that can then be mindily and spiritually uplifted,
right,
in subsequent dispensations. But
okay.
Because they defaulted, they didn't make up for the rebellion, and so here we are. We have very little of all that was supposed to have happened over those 525,000 years.
Okay, let me ask you this though, Chris. You were saying that we're not, even though we're not going to get another material son and daughter. What I'm asking, the reason I was asking about the sudden.
Mm-hmm.
Leaps of evolution or sudden gift of revelation is, do you see anytime soon, do you see any kind of superhuman intervention like life carriers coming down here and helping us with this process, or do you think that we're going to have to wait till light and life for that to happen?
Well, some of the revelators talk about how they speculate on this endlessly. And the key in this regard is their speculation that when Machiavelli Melchizedek sometime assumes, the mantle of planetary prince, he will also assume the mantle of material son.
Wow.
Which means he will manifest in corporeal form, just like Adam and Eve, and he will directly engage this very difficult issue of all of this 525,000 years of biologic chaos. We are in such a difficult state of beginning to have motivations towards light and life when we haven't even done the first step yet. You can't get the light in life when you've got such biologic chaos. You can't build such an exalted structure upon sand.
Exactly.
So when they contemplate this, they go, they're saying they can't see any way around it besides someone like Machiavelli very definitively stepping in and addressing this issue, dealing with this, because it needs to happen. We need to get this foundation laid, because the Supreme is moving on apace, as it were. they do speculate that, and not only Machiavelli, but they speculate other things too. You might get other individuals that would join in on that process, but.
Well, they say that they fully they wouldn't be surprised if Machiavelli, Melchizedek showed up with Adam and Eve and a magisterial son.
Or if not Adam and Eve, maybe some of Adam and Eve's children, or on the Densha or whatnot. Yeah, I mean, there's endless speculation by the Revelers about this. They encourage us to think about that, that issue too. The whole point being, there are many options, and the ball will not be dropped. What needs to happen will happen. If definitive father-like insertion into this process is necessary, then that will happen to the extent that it needs to happen, great or small. You could get a very significant insertion of the hand of the Father with both Machiavelli and Melchizedek and a magisterial son, working together. That magisterial son also comes in corporeal form on his first mission, and he comes with a staff of 12 Melchizedeks, also in corporeal form. This could be a very grand suddenly.
That would rock our world, let's just put it that way.
Yeah, that would pretty much get everyone's attention. My name is Machiavelli Melchizedek, and I'm the ruler of this world. And things are about to change.
Okay,
yeah.
But I know this is kind of apocryphal, what I'm about to say, but there's a lot of speculation that says that the Arantia book is supposed to be here for 1,000 years. I've heard that people make that claim, some of the old-timers make that claim. Now, of course, the word 1,000 is an interesting word, and the word millennium. The book also says Urantia will not settle down complacently for a millennium, and it says we can't anticipate the discoveries of 1,000 years. So it uses that word 1,000. I don't know if they're using the word 1,000 literally, or if they're using it the way the Bible uses it, which is sort of symbolically, like God owns the cattle on 1,000 hills.
No, they're using it in a fairly literal sense. To work out, remember, the millennium is not just that mythical notion. That's one of the interesting revelations, is that the reason that we have that mythical notion of the millennium is because it's tied to an actual grand universe fact, there's that cycle of roughly 1,000 years in Havona that, which the whole universe keys to.
Well, let me tell you why I brought that up. The reason I brought that up is because I could be wrong. My sense is that they want the Urantia revelation, the book, to make its impact for 1,000 years before they give us any other superhuman. I know some people disagree. Talk to some readers back like we're going to hit light and life tomorrow. What's your take on that, Chris? Do you think that they want the Urantia book as a revelation to make its impact before we have any other kind of superhuman intervention?
The thing you have to keep in mind with a thought like that is you're thinking very linearly.
Okay.
The farther along you get in the evolution of the Supreme, the more potentials for non-linear phenomenon, where you don't have to, take one thing, take it to its end point, and then and only then start up the next thing. Things begin to lay on top of each other, and you have more and more super additive relationship manifesting because they're simultaneous. That's what I was saying. I mean, if you have both Machiavelli Melchizedek and the magisterial son, see, that's a huge super additive potential for them to work together, and address all three dispensations basically simultaneously. In the context of Michael having already come and initiated the bestowal dispensation,
so
there's a huge super additive potential that could in a very short period of time, overcome this huge deficit of the normal linear-like evolution of things. You know, that 525,000 years, or even if you throw in the magisterial sun, you know, you have 550 or more years of kind of linear sort of evolution before the bestowal, you know, sun comes. So, but we could make up for all that in a very suddenly like span of time.
The Urantia book is a similar super additive kind of a phenomenon, just as you pointed out. I
mean, exactly. Yeah, and
think about how many beings participated in that revelation, and you know, powerful beings, amazing. If you read the book, you realize that these are no lightweight beings. You know,
yeah.
They're super in their own right, super additive beings. You know, and
yeah.
So that's
and they,
a in, to get us
right.
ready for the magisterial sun. Certainly, to me, I think it has a precursor kind of effect to it. It's like saying, okay, this is to get you ready for some super additive things that are going to happen here shortly.
Yeah, and just remember, you know, if and when they come here, you know, in the near future, that doesn't mean that the fifth ethical revelation no longer has any place.
Right.
They come to help us engage the truths of the fifth ethical revelation and realize the fullness of it, and you know, augment it with their own subsequent revelation. I mean, in the case of the magisterial son, you know, he is coming as a further revelation, and the Urantia book as the fifth ethical revelation is definitely synchronized with the magisterial sun. It's part of the mindful philosophical upliftment of mankind,
right?
So that science and religion can find their true place in the cosmos.
Okay, I want to get into some practical nuts and bolts, non-abstract kinds of things, the kind of stuff that provokes controversy among people. Okay, and I want you to start, Chris, by reading. I want you to read the last paragraph of paper 68, because it's the dawn of civilization here, because it's got an interesting paragraph, and I'll tell you why I want you to read it after you read it. I'll tell you why I want to discuss it.
So okay, that very last one that starts with "from a world standpoint."
Yes.
Okay, from a world standpoint, overpopulation has never been a serious problem in the past. But if war is lessened and science increasingly controls human diseases, it may become a serious problem in the near future. At such a time, the great test of the wisdom of world leadership will present itself. Will your Urantia rulers have the insight and courage to foster the multiplication of the average or stabilized human being instead of the extremes of the supernormal and the enormously increasing groups of the subnormal? The normal man should be fostered. He is the backbone of civilization and the source of the mutant geniuses of the race. The subnormal man should be kept under society's control. No more should be produced than are required to administer the lower levels of industry. Those tasks requiring intelligence above the animal level, but making such low-grade demands as to prove veritable slavery and bondage for the higher types of mankind.
Okay. The reason I want you to read that is this. I'm gonna take our listeners back a couple weeks ago. One of our guests made a statement on the air that I thought was pretty, was frankly a bit irrational. They said that we got into a discussion of, we started talking about all kinds of different things. We were talking about race issues and slavery and all kinds of, we started discussing, and one of the guests happened to bring up the fact that she thought it was terrible that vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin would bring a, quote, inferior child into the world, you know, because the child had Down syndrome, and I think she was implying that what she did was socially irresponsible and terrible and all sort of stuff. You know, and again, I can see some readers, I've showed this passage to readers, okay, some readers who will say, well, we're not supposed to have any subnormals at all. They shouldn't be reproducing at all. But that's not what this book is saying. That's not what this passage is saying. It's saying, no, it's okay to have subnormal people as long as you keep their numbers under control and they don't outnumber the rest of society and they don't become, you know, they don't become a serious problem. So they're not saying that you can't have any subnormal people at all. And we also should need to remember that on the planet of light and life, you have the superhuman administrators allow, they divide people into groups, and people in certain groups can have half as many children as those in the other groups. So they're not saying that people shouldn't be reproducing at all. They're just trying to keep the numbers to a minimum. I'm bringing this up because, again, I think it's very easy for people to have this slash-and-burn approach to eugenics. I find that people tend to be very polarized on this issue. They tend to either say, we're going to have, we should just completely forget about these papers on eugenics, or I can't read the book at all because there's no way I can advocate eugenics. It's a terrible thing. Or you get people say, well, yeah, let's round up all the defectives and sterilize everybody, you know. And so, and by the way, I think it's interesting, too, that they also say that they don't want only the supernormal reproducing. They want the average or stabilized human being, which, from my understanding of that passage, means that they want people who are kind of, you know, run the gamut, for anybody from the blue-collar worker to the college professor. kind of, what's your take on that, Chris?
Okay, well, there's a number of things there. First of all, the word normal. the word normal is evolves. You know, the fact of what's behind the word normal evolves. The hand of the supreme, you know, that's evolving mankind, ever moves forward. And so, like, when you're way back in that first dispensation of the planetary prince, normal is a very primitive fact. By the time you get into, you know, the later stages of light and life, normal is a very, very advanced fact.
Sure, sure.
Okay? And so this spectrum, it moves forward. You know, that which is sub and super to normal is ever progressing. Now, let me read you that, passage you were alluding to when they're talking about the ages of light and life. Where they're saying the mortals on a planet during this age are divided into from 5 to 10 groups, and the lower groups are permitted to produce only one half as many children as the higher. The continued improvement of such a magnificent race, notice singular race, throughout the era of light and life is largely a matter of the selective reproduction of those racial strains which exhibit superior qualities of a social, philosophic, cosmic, and spiritual nature. And that last little bit is very important. Think about when I was talking about this whole process of selective reproduction in those early stages. I mean, everything that you can that comes to mind when you think about selective reproduction, or, you know, assessing the character of mankind and managing that, everything you can think of is ancient history at the point of this passage that I just read. Mm-hmm. I mean, everyone alive today would be in the lowest category, if not below the lowest category, of what they're talking about is the lowest category in this age of light and life. I mean, all the biologic, all the racial, all of the basic mindal stuff was taken care of before the bestowal dispensation, you know, which was long before the ages of light and life. I mean, the bestowal dispensation lasts anywhere from 10,000 to 100,000 years, you know, and then the Trinity teacher son dispensations, you know, they say you have at least 1,000 years and often a lot longer. So you have thousands and thousands and thousands of years after, of advancing character of mankind after anything that we can currently imagine.
And what I'm getting from what you're saying, Chris, is that, and that very important last part that you pointed out, a person can have a disease. You know, it seems like genetics is so concerned now about backing up and making sure that biological structure is sound. And certainly if the biological structure is sound, a person can live a more happy, well-balanced life if they don't have to deal with disease. But when the celestial realm is looking at us, they're not looking at the fact that we have to deal with a disease so much. I mean, you can deal with a disease and still be an extremely beautiful, social, spiritual person.
Right, but again, being very humble about that thought and remembering that what we imagine as a very beautiful, social, spiritual person is so limited relative to where we will eventually be. Remember, they tell you that when you get into by the time you get into the age of light and life, I mean, even before that, if I remember right, I believe it's when they're talking about the Trinity teachers on missions. Here, let me just go to that passage. Yeah, during the Trinity teachers on dispensation, so post-bestowal, it says that the individuals, you know, in those civilizations are occupied with 1,000 things of interest unknown on your world.
That's right. And when I think about
we don't even have any concept of what our potential is yet, because we're working on such a minimal foundation. We can reach up as high as we can reach, and we're barely reaching up anywhere.
Okay, but let me ask you this. The passage you read, Chris, about from the Light and Life paper about how the depends on the racial strains, they're having the superior qualities of a spiritual, a cosmic.
Of social, philosophic, cosmic and spiritual nature.
Okay, let me ask you something. Is there some sort of genetic basis then for spirituality and that kind of thing? I mean,
yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Yes. It all builds.
Talk more about that. Talk more about that.
Well, it all builds up from the bottom. You start with just the basic molecular system, and that has to be well composed in order for the life animation to engage that to its fullest. For instance, that engagement of the life animation degrades with time, but by the time you get into the bestowal sun era, you've improved that engagement to the point where you live about 300 years. By the time you get to the Trinity teacher sun, you've improved that engagement to the point where you live on average 500 years. That's all about improving that engagement of the life animation to the molecules. Once you have a very solid foundation there of an animated material system, then non-teachable mechanical mind can engage that to its fullest. And then upon that, agitant mind, teachable mind, can engage that to its fullest. All the way up to the seventh adjutant, all the way up to the spirit of wisdom, can engage the whole system underneath it to its fullest. And then the Holy Spirit and cosmic mind, the three cosmic intuitions and the Holy Spirit, can engage that system to its fullest. Okay, now we're starting to talk about something that's truly spiritual.
Okay.
We've built up through matter and mind all the way up to something that the Holy Spirit can engage to its fullest, the Spirit of Truth can engage to its fullest, the thought adjusters can engage to its fullest.
It's like firing on all cylinders instead of just one.
Right.
Yeah.
Are you
all predicated on that, you know, that foundation.
Okay, are you talking about...
Andre,
like,
people have asked, please speak up again.
I'm sorry, there's a place in the Social Problems of Religion paper, I think it's paper 99, where they talk about how religion must be predicated on sound and normal heredity. And when I think about that, I guess one of the things that comes to my mind for me is, for example, an absence of mental illness. Because one of the things that happens with people who are mentally ill, they can become religious, but then what ends up happening is they confuse their religion with their psychological disturbances and things like that. So is that part of what you're talking about here with the genetic foundation?
Yeah, and one way to kind of clarify that thought, it's one thing to talk about religion where it's kind of a loose usage of the word. I mean, many people think it's a synonym for superstition. Okay, it doesn't take much of a biologic foundation to be superstitious.
Here, here.
You can have a pretty primitive human with lots of problems that can manifest all kinds of superstition, and illusion. True religion.
Primitive religion kind of starts out that way anyway.
Right, of course it does. Yeah, I mean, it can't start out any other way. It's in primitive man. But when you're talking about true religion, religion that is synchronized with the cosmos, that's what the adjective true means, the cosmos is not just spiritual. It is the harmonization of material and spiritual. The supreme is both the almighty supreme, the controller, and the supreme being, the creator. Both material and spiritual, both individuality and unity, and those are blended together and manifest as the supreme mind. The cosmos is matter, mind, and spirit in perfect synchrony. So true religion must synchronize with that fullness of the cosmos. It's not just purely a spiritual thing. Once you begin to really reflect on what the meaning of putting true, the adjective true in front of it is. You have science, philosophy, and religion as starting points. But the truer those become, the more they become one thing, mode of consciousness. So that true religion is that spiritual facet of that one consciousness, as opposed to being a separate thought, a separate track. Especially one half of a dichotomy between science and religion. Anything that is still manifest as a dichotomy, or any thoughts of understanding the world through dichotomies, there's no truth there. I mean, dichotomies reflect a lack of synchrony with the cosmos. There is no dichotomy in the supreme.
Well,
the Almighty the Almighty Supreme and the Supreme Being are one.
Yeah, and it always holds up symmetry as the apex, the balance, the symmetry. It talks about Jesus's integrated personality. And, of course, he was the living example of what you just described, that, true religion, the living example of true religion.
Yeah, he wasn't a wild-eyed mystic, flying way off on one side of the dichotomy, on the spiritual side of the dichotomy. He was a perfectly balanced individual. He was synchronized with the cosmos.
And getting to genetics, then, obviously he had a good genetic makeup, and of course the book tells us that the planetary supervisors searched for that good genetic makeup to bestow the Creator's Son in that particular genetic body, so that he would have at least that foundation to build from.
And just like Jesus often used his analogy in his parables, Jesus couldn't be built upon sand.
Right.
And
or
Gabriel knew that.
You wouldn't set out to build a structure with rotten and wormy wood. The carpenter looks for the good wood to build the foundation with. And I think that's what we're talking about.
Yeah.
And the difficulty that we have as humanity is then, what we've been saying, how do we go back now and correct the structure that's already been built with rotten and wormy wood? Or do we, and is it going to take superhuman intervention? Maybe so,
It probably will.
Yeah, I just can't see how we'll be able to do it on our own. It's too big. It's bigger than we are.
But we must face the facts, though. Like you were saying, Andre, it is a false choice between closing our eyes and pretending that there is no such thing as eugenics, because we think it's defined by the most ignorant that have lived, and we don't want to look at such ugly things, so we just close our eyes and hum, that it's that, or it's you know, just stepping in and declaring yourself Lord over all and you know, sterilizing people. I mean, that's just a false dichotomy.
Yes, it is.
You need to face the facts and adjust them to our ideals. And this is a difficult thing, like I was saying, because the facts we're facing are very primitive. The ideals that we can conceive are advancing on rapidly.
Right.
The ideals begin to touch upon light and life. The facts are back in primitive man stages. This is a huge differential that we have to harmonize. It will require great wisdom to face those facts and adjust them to our ideals. That's the challenge in front of us. And like you're saying, Paula, it is a bit hard to imagine that we can muster this on our own. So we shouldn't be surprised if in the not-too-distant future we get some wisdom infusion. You know, the magisterial son is the upstepper of wisdom.
Right,
yeah.
There you go. We just don't have the objectivity, really.
I want
to
make sure that we...
To...
I'm sorry, go ahead, Paula.
No, go ahead.
I just want to make sure we give up a phone number, that's all.
We have Albert on the line who'd like to make some comments about genetics, I think.
What's the area code?
All right. 303?
Hello? Am I on the air or not?
You're
yes,
on
you
the
are.
Air.
Yeah, you're on.
Okay, great. Greetings, everyone.
Hi.
Hello, Albert.
Hi, Chris. Lovely to listen to you. It's sound on these issues. What inspired me to call at this particular time in your conversation is to integrate this issue that you're just touching on is, you know, where are we at now and how we might involve ourselves and cooperate with the unfolding of this process. And while there are these aspects that are very mysterious, you know, when will we get another visitation, and we can, you know, have a lot of speculations about that are very worthwhile, it's another line of inquiry to say, okay, well, here we are right now with a particular epical revelation at a certain stage in its evolutionary development in our culture. And, okay, so what's going on? You know, what options do we have for action and strategic wise initiative so that we might enjoy the exquisite opportunity to participate in the unfolding of these events? You know, one of the things I was discussing last night with some readers here in New England where I'm at is we're talking about how Christianity developed, quite a pace culturally, in spite of the fact that most people never read the Bible. You know, we didn't even get printing presses till, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years after it was initially canonized and most people were illiterate, and yet Christianity emerged as a very dominant force culturally, and everybody knew, you know, some fundamental truths or aspects of what was in the Bible and about Jesus' life and such like this. And I think that we're in a current situation where this is also very possible. You know, sometimes we think about the Urantia book having a profound effect on culture in terms of just numbers of people. You know, and we just have to keep getting it out to numbers. And we sometimes don't take cognizance of the incredible potentials that are inherent in the leadership of culture and how getting out to a lot of leaders and why we might be able to quite efficiently and effectively start to create some transformation that way. Why that means we could be extraordinarily effective in bringing the enhanced values and truths and perspective of the Urantia book to the world, quite apart from the time it would take, you know, most of the world to read the whole book or any of those types of issues. And so with the things I'm looking at these days in terms of how the science is catching up to the history in the Urantia book very powerfully, and how genetics as a field of study is bringing about some very interesting correlations, and how all of this provides us opportunities to do enhanced outreach with the academic community. Well, you know, I look at all of this and think, wow, you know, no matter when we get another visitation, no matter how long things take, we're in the midst of extraordinary opportunities right now where we can intelligently direct ourselves to the levers and mechanisms of the type of, you know, that can create a dramatic social change and relatively suddenly.
Yeah, and in that overall perspective, I think I would remind everyone of that there's a twofold process in play with the fifth epical revelation. The book itself and the potential for greater recognition of truth inherent in it is the hand of the Father being inserted into the stream of time. You know, it's a revelation, an epical revelation. And relative to it, you know, and this issue of how are we going to deal with this very difficult differential between the facts and our ideals as we move forward, we need to encourage those who have discovered the revelation and those who we would awaken to the revelation that you must bring humility to the table. You know, the revelation has no value if you don't humble yourself first and allow yourself to strike step with the greater truths. Yeah, especially when you're dealing with an issue where a lot of people come to the revelation with a huge pile of baggage, like eugenics. You need to know, like you were saying, Paula, back at the beginning of the show, that the individuals that wrote the revelation or saw to it that it got created are very, very brilliant and very, very wise, and there is great truth potential if you can get yourself out of the way, stop using it as a mirror, you know, stop using it as a source of affirmation, and begin to actually use it as a source of revelation to reform your mind. So there's that. You know, if mankind could strike step with the truths of the fifth epical revelation, we could begin to very wisely deal with some of these issues. But
and I think Halbert's question was, what do you see, Chris, as some of the things that we could actually do to actually participate in this grand adventure rather than just waiting for the intervention of celestial beings, because the problems are overwhelming, there's no doubt about that. Obviously, there's things we can do to actively participate. So what do you think some of the first things?
Well, before we talk about any specifics, see, before we talk about facts, we have to have a relationship with truth. The beginning of the 20th century is a great example of what happens when man approaches the subject of eugenics without truth first. It created a catastrophe.
Right.
You know, so much so that it's going to take us a long time before, you know, it's even acceptable to say the word, you know, in public.
I want to piggyback on that, because let's be direct about that. The catastrophe that was created was not just the thing that people think of immediately. They think, oh, it was the Holocaust, it was Hitler. Even before that, we had forcible sterilizations going on in America. And by the way, just at the risk of creating controversy, I'm not saying that I'm opposed to sterilizations in every circumstance. I think there are cases where that may be appropriate, especially if it's ordered by a judge and not just by some bureaucrat who thinks that they know better. But if it's, you know, something, if it's, you know, done by a family court, or if it's, you know,
if you had competent judges, that might be an approach.
Yeah,
and family courts.
I'm sorry, what did you say, Paula?
Yeah.
Well, family courts, one of the things your Rancho Book holds up for
yes,
government
yes.
on a neighboring
yeah, although
planet.
Although we need juries on our family courts.
But see, yeah, that was my whole point. You're not going to have any of these competent individuals, judges or bureaucrats or otherwise, unless they've struck step with the fifth epical revelation. That's why it's here.
Okay, I see what you're saying.
Right.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. So we need to, yeah. So that, okay, but the thing, there's something I want to mention.
Might still on the line?
Oh.
Not on the line.
Oh.
Hello?
What?
Yeah, you're still on the line, Albert.
Yeah, you are.
If I could take a moment to address that specifically, you know, I think so often the conversation does sort of jump a couple steps ahead to, oh, we don't have competent leaders and the problems inherent in that. And, of course, it's very important to appreciate that. But then that, of course, brings us back to the question, well, what can we do about it right now and what's going on? And so I want the listeners to know who are tuning in with us that, in fact, right now I'm working on a report called Eugenics, Race, and the Urantia book that'll soon be posted on UB The News, and it's going to start to make its way into the university communities. And naturally, this is going to be bringing awareness to exactly what the Urantia book says on the issue of genetics. And one of the, or eugenics, I mean, and one of the brilliant things the authors have done for us, touching back on what Chris says about the incredible brilliance of the authorship, is they have used the word only once in the book, and they used it in the part of the book that has to do with the soul and the inner life. So anyone who is trying to discuss how the Urantia book authors use the word eugenics are forced, by lack of options, to go to this section that says things like, ideas may take origin in the stimuli of the outer world, but ideals are born only in the creative realms of the inner world. Today, the nations of the world are directed by men who have a superabundance of ideas, but they are poverty-stricken in ideals. That is the explanation of poverty, divorce, war, and racial hatred. So the Urantia book takes people right into this issue of the implications of eugenics in relationship to our spirituality, to fundamental truth, to the integration, as Chris was saying, what's true has cosmic integration. And so here's where our exquisite revelation with these brilliant authors comes to us with, you know, statements like, how can a creative imagination produce worthy children when the stage whereon it functions is already preoccupied by prejudice, hate, fears, resentments, revenge, and bigotries? So at the same time that it's using the word eugenics, it's forcing us to confront these issues of values. And this, I believe, is this is magic, in a sense, if I can use the word very
well. Let me I want to bring up
it's creative up, genius.
But I want to bring up
creative
something,
genius.
Chris, that you
that's
brought up.
A much better use of terminology.
Chris, I want to bring up something you brought up, though, Chris. You said that we can't even discuss the word eugenics right now. There's one thing I did want to mention. I looked up the concept of, I looked up the word eugenics in Wikipedia to see what they had to say about it. And actually, they were much more it was more a very balanced, interesting article, more than you might think. One of the things that they said in there is that there is a discipline or a I don't know, a science or whatever you call it, called liberal eugenics. And they're using the word liberal here not in the sense of something being left-wing as opposed to right-wing. They're using the word liberal, I think, in the classical sense of freedom. What they're saying is that it's the idea is that it's advocating eugenics but without coercion or a minimal amount of coercion. And I thought that was very interesting. That someone is talking about that. It reminded me a little bit of something that happened in my own life. I have a disease that caused my blindness. It's called Norrie's disease, okay? And it could cause me to go deaf, too, but I don't think that's going to happen because it was supposed to stop progressing when I was 30, and I'm 39 now, which means I'm really old. But anyway, what I was going to say was that the disease also can cause mental retardation in some children. It can cause violent behavior. It can cause all kinds of other things, okay? Now, my sister took a genetic blood test from her blood some years ago, back in 1993, and she decided that she was going to see if she was a carrier of this disease. because she said that if she was a carrier, said she wouldn't mind having a blind child, and she didn't want a deaf child, and she didn't want a child who was severely retarded or violent or any of those other things. So she was going to see if she was a carrier, and if she was a carrier, she was going to look into adopting children and getting her tubes tied. That was perfect, completely voluntary. There was no coercion involved by anybody, and it was a perfectly, you know, again, it was. I guess you could say it was in the tradition of liberal eugenics. So the only point I'm making is that there are people who are talking about these things, and it's not, you know, completely politically incorrect.
Right, and I was going to make that point that this is, you know, this facing the facts. The facts of eugenics are not going to go away. It doesn't matter how much you close your eyes and hum, they're not going to go away. They're just going to be more and more unavoidable. The more we know about genetics, the more unavoidable this is. And if you, you know, get people off camera, you know, in the scientific community, and ask them about this, you know, they will admit that, you know, they are still thinking about eugenics. They just don't talk about it in public, or if they do, they've created euphemisms or tacked on adjectives like that to try to soften it or something, you know. I mean, genetics is a fact, and it's not going anywhere. It's just going to be more and more in our face as we go forward. And that's why the revelators address it so directly. We need help in facing this. We can't ignore it. It needs to be addressed.
You know, I have to share a little story with you guys about what happened to me one time doing a lecture to a group of New Age thinkers, and it was on the stages of evolution and how we might get to a better place from where we are, and I kind of spelled out the stages of the epical evolutionary stages that the Urantia book talks about, and I mentioned in this talk the idea of eliminating retrograde genes and genetics and that kind of thing. And it set off a firestorm within this group because one of the women in the group had a retarded child. And her point of view, and it was shared by many in the group, was this child chose to come in retarded. And that because this child was retarded and because this child chose to come in retarded, this retarded child blessed everybody around it because they had to deal with it. They had to grow spiritually through the issues that this child brought in. And I'm like, wow, how do you deal with that? I mean, there's really nothing you can say. And I tried to point out that I don't think any child would choose to come in retarded. I don't think anybody wants to be blind or deaf or mentally retarded or debilitated with spinal bifida or, you know, any host of a million maladies that little children have to learn to deal with and parents have to deal with. Autism now is the latest one. So it's interesting that you know, they try to explain away this. You're talking about putting your hands on your ears and humming, Chris. They try to explain away these problems by saying, well, they meant to do it that way. That's all a part of the plan that, you know, they chose to come in with this malady.
Right, and it's just, you know, it's so upside down. that it's because humans have a tendency to go in that kind of convoluted direction of rationalization that the fifth epical revelation is here. It's its purpose. We so desperately need a logical foundation for all our thought, not just in eugenics, but everything you can think of, science, religion, everything is so desperately in need of a solid cosmic foundation. Like I try to point out to many people, fundamentally in terms of philosophy, what the Urantia book represents is a better set of initial assumptions. You can rationalize anything. You can start with some thought, something that, because of your experiences or bias or whatever, you're attracted to. So you start with that initial assumption, and you can rationalize anything from that starting point. The question is not whether you can rationalize things. The question is whether or not it's logical, whether or not it conforms to the cosmos. And how do you get those proper initial assumptions? Well, they tell us you don't have moda, consciousness, so you cannot conceive those proper initial assumptions. Only revelation can give them to you.
Right.
That's
okay.
The purpose of the fifth level rite,
to
give us the proper starting
point. But I want to go back to what Paula brought up here, because I think there's some of what those people in the audience are saying is ridiculous. Obviously, nobody chooses to come into the world with cancer, or nobody chooses to come into the world at all, actually.
Never mind, yeah, you don't have any choice.
You don't have a choice about being born. So that's true. Okay, now, having said that, that part is ridiculous. But I do think there's a certain amount of truth to what this lady in the audience was saying about a retarded child. Because I think, and this is where I think we need to recognize what the book is saying here, because I agree with you, Chris, that in the final analysis there are no real dichotomies, but the book does use dichotomies because we need them right now. Like, there's a dichotomy between the social and the spiritual. There's a dichotomy between the political and the spiritual. So what I guess I'm saying is this. On an individual level, I think it's true that people do have to grow, they do grow spiritually by maybe, you know, they might grow spiritually by having a retarded child. That's true on a small scale.
The Supreme can work with any set of of initial facts.
Right. And so the thing is,
and move it towards good.
In fact, I think we should also point out, I think one of the things you point out earlier, Paula, is about the antisocial, there are certain genetic abnormalities that the authors are more concerned about than others. Okay, for example, there's a place I think in the Planetary Mortal Epochs paper where they talk about it is neither tenderness nor altruism to bestow futile sympathy on the antisocial degenerate strains and people who forfeited their spiritual birthright. Okay, and then it says on normal worlds there exists there exist sufficient differences for all those noble traits of altruism to be manifested. I think you can make a case that if someone has a retarded child, or a child with some other kind of disability, that's an opportunity for altruism to flourish on the part of the parent. Now the other thing we need to remember too is yes, we do need to improve as a human race. That's true genetically, but on the other hand, the Supreme is using this, as you said, Chris, because we're a planet of Agendaughters. We're a planet of, there are going to be things that, look at the Havona natives. There are things that we have to deal with that they don't have to deal with, and they're envious of us. So I do think, on a small scale, I think that what that lady in the audience said makes sense. I think where it becomes a problem, and this is where I think we need to look very practically and clinically, kind of with detachment about those pastures on eugenics. I think where it becomes a problem is when, let's see if I can put it to you this way. I'm speaking as a disabled person, okay? I am blind. Now, I try to be as independent as I can be, but the fact is that people who are disabled are dependent on able-bodied people to one extent or another for their sustenance or for whatever, okay? So we have to make sure that the number of able-bodied people in our society outnumbers the number of disabled people, because if we had the opposite situation, it would be chaos. So there are just practical considerations that need to be addressed. There are issues of numbers that need to be addressed. It's just a matter of common sense.
Yeah, and always what we have to encourage people is to think about all these issues in an evolutionary context rather than in this static context that everyone approaches these issues in, where initially because of the rebellion and the default, like I was saying, we have an experience potential that doesn't exist very often in the universe, where someone with relatively high consciousness of ideals has the opportunity to engage someone with some very harsh biologic or mindal defects. And there's an opportunity for love there that doesn't exist, definitely doesn't exist in Havona, and doesn't exist in most of the seven super universes.
Wow.
You know, most worlds are not as abnormal as we are. So there is that great potential, but don't then take the next step, the next false step of saying, oh, well, we should try to preserve that stark differential for all time.
Right.
Well, and Halbert made a point about having a stage where on the stage is set. And that makes me think that one of the opportunities we have, or at least those on the planet who have a higher consciousness, is to set a stage, which is about helping to create an environment that brings forth greater potentials for everybody. Because, you know, it's like from...
Am I still on the line, or am I not on the line?
Oh.
Hello. Am I on
the line? You are.
Okay. Before we get any further from Paula's original comment about the person who brought up the issue of, you know, being chosen to be born retarded, I want to remind us that there are very practical things that that we can do when someone says something like that. And one of the things that type of comment indicates is that I think the general population, in contrast to our leadership, does have an abundance of ideals, but not an abundance of ideas. And we can use Jesus' teaching to honor the values that people have as a way to reach them and appreciate where they're coming from. That woman was trying to make the best of a bad situation. That exhibits noble character. She may have attached some ideas to that we think don't make any sense. But if we start with a person like that by acknowledging the ideals inherent in their beliefs, and you know, don't focus right away on the logic or how it relates to your Rancho Book theology and all of that, we have an opportunity to reach them, because once we've acknowledged that we appreciate and have some empathy for where they're coming from, then we can start to introduce new ideas. You know, that's often where the disconnect and the breakdown in conversation comes on a very practical level around these issues, is that people, for instance, want to shut down the whole conversation about eugenics for very wholesome reasons. It might not be the best idea to shut down the conversation, but there's at least an opportunity to acknowledge that people are concerned about how atrocities have occurred in the past. And so I just want to, you know, encourage us to be mindful that, you know, sometimes we're led to focus on the ideas being errant from our viewpoint and miss the opportunity to communicate quite effectively with someone who's got a different idea, but
yeah.
who has
yeah,
ideals that are similar to our own.
Right. The point of me bringing up that, you know, recognizing that the revelation offers a much broader, sounder set of initial assumptions upon which to understand your experiences and to understand the world around you. It's, you know, it's not so that you can wield that as a club, obviously. it's so you can do what Jesus did. Where, like you were saying, Halbert, he always very graciously met the individual in front of him where they were, but never did they dwell at that meeting point very long. He immediately began to move them towards greater truth.
Yeah.
Because he knew the direction. You know, there's no way that any of us are going to be able to help a person move from their starting point towards greater truth if we know not the direction ourselves. Yeah, that's why I was saying you must create a relationship with the truth of the revelation first before you have any hope of being successful in engaging others and being able to do what Jesus did so many times, so magnificently.
And obviously, people didn't always agree with Jesus. Some people seriously disagreed with Jesus to the point where they sought after his death. They so seriously disagreed with the truth that he was offering in his gentle and loving way.
Yeah.
But
if they close their eyes and plug their ears and hum, there's nothing you can do.
You still have to tell the truth. You still, at least to your highest understanding of it. And Andre brought up a really good point, and that is that his sister consciously made a choice not to, you know, to find out whether or not she carried this, you know, the gene for this disease. And I think that, you know, people, that's based on experience. She obviously saw what her brother went through, what her parents went through, and she made a conscious decision. Do I want to go through that? Do I want to bring a child into the world who has to go, who has to deal with that?
But wait a minute, Paula, wait, I got to stop you for a second, because she wasn't concerned about having a blind child. She was concerned about the other possible disabilities the disease could cause.
Well, certainly, and I mean, but my point is that she made a conscious decision based on those possibilities, you know, and she must have had some experience with the difficulties you went through and your parents in dealing with that, and she decided, well, I could deal with that, but maybe I couldn't deal with this.
Right, I see what you're saying.
That's all based on her experience. She had real-life experience with it. And, you know, certainly the people who bring retarded children into the world have to make the decision, do we want to keep continuing to bring retarded children into the world that somebody has to take care of, that, you know, and there's different levels of retardation, obviously.
Right.
You had mentioned the person a couple weeks ago that talked about Sarah Palin's child. Some retarded children require extensive care all of their lives. They're never able to do anything for themselves. And others can, you know, actually hold down a job and be productive to some degree, at least self-maintaining.
And obviously, you know, if we don't develop very, very sophisticated understanding of genetics so that we don't have to face this very difficult decision, you know, after it's all unfolded, I mean, we need to deal with this before conception.
Right.
Yes, I agree with that 100%. I agree. And, you know, and it's funny because I want to. It's funny you should mention that, Chris. I want to bring something else up. This again is a practical issue that we're dealing with in our society. I agree with what you're saying, Chris. That we need to embrace the truth of the fifth apocryphal revelation as a society. Essentially, correct me if I'm wrong. You're just saying that before we really, mm-hmm. really start taking this issue head on, because one of the things that's happening, for example. Now, the fact is, whether you realize it or not, or whether we realize it, the fact is eugenics is still being practiced today. It's just not called eugenics. You know, there's a lot. I've been reading a lot about. And next week I'm gonna try to get some people to debate the whole issue of when life begins, you know, conception or whatever, you know, and use the Arantia book. But I wanna get into the issue of abortion for just a second, not because I don't wanna, you know, get into my position on it or anything. But one thing that does concern me is there are doctors who are pressuring women to have abortions if they have a child that might be retarded or defective. And there are a couple of problems I have with that. One is I hope that eugenics doesn't become some kind of a weapon that is used to beat people over the head and make them feel like they are doing something irresponsible if they decide to bring a retarded child into the world or whatever. The other thing that people don't realize is a lot of times doctors misdiagnose people, you know, babies. You know, they say the baby's not going to be able to breathe, they're not going to be able to see, and in many cases that doesn't happen. So, you know, I that's why I agree with what you're saying, Chris, when you say that that, you know, we're going to have to embrace the truth of the fifth apocryphal revelation of society before we really, you know, take this issue on, because we've got to look at this just like every other issue. We've got to look at it with spiritually advanced and enlightened.
Well, we need cosmic consciousness about it. We need more than just spiritual consciousness.
Yes.
That's the very difficult thing. But in that regard, let me follow up. We were talking about what kind of things are in play that are going to help with this. Besides mankind striking step with the truths of the revelation, to have the wisdom and to have the objectivity that we need, that's the hand of the Father. The hand of the Mother is also working on this in parallel. Over the last few hundred years, her adjutant mind hand, you know, through the local universe Mother Spirit, has been progressively being able to engage mankind as a collective phenomenon to higher and higher degrees. And we've had the fourth adjutant engage the collective, and the fifth adjutant, and the sixth adjutant has engaged the collective. You know, not just the individual that it's been engaged with for a million years, but it's beginning to be able to engage the whole. And we're quivering on the very brink of the seventh adjutant, engaging the collective, the dawning of wisdom in the collective mind of man. And you know, that will transform many difficult issues like this, because not only do you have wisdom, a collective understanding after that, or at least a growing collective understanding after that, the moment the seventh adjutant engages a collective, the Holy Spirit can engage the collective, and not just individuals, but can engage the whole. And that means you have objective consciousness beginning to dawn in the collective mind. More and more, our culture, our civilization will reflect a self-evident consciousness, you know, in the collective, where many things, you know, will be self-evident, and
it's like
there won't be any controversy in dealing with them. So, you know, between the revelation and this evolving hand of the Supreme in mind, you know, we're going to have what we need, and it's all going to be ripe. The two together give the magisterial son everything he needs to be able to come. You know, it's the properly tilled soil that he needs to plant in. That's why it's because we're quivering on the very brink of the precursors. You know that you know, the new dispensation is at hand. That whole quote of Jesus about the spiritual springtime and the summer of a new dispensation, i.e. the magisterial son, is at hand. We won't have to go very long, because it's obvious we can't go very long in our ignorance with this. This is going to cause catastrophe in the hands of ignorant children. All of this information, which we won't be able to move towards knowledge and wisdom, we'll just distort into, you know, horrendous darkness.
Hitler was maybe just a foretaste of how bad that can be.
Yeah. You know, the fact that everything happened like it did in the first half of the 20th century, again, reminds you that the fifth ethical revelation is an emergency revelation. They needed to insert this, just like Machiavelli needed to insert himself in 1980 BC. Because the hand of the father needs to coordinate with the hand of the mother here.
Do you think, Chris, let me ask you this. Do you think, you mentioned that the fact that things went the way they did in the first half of the 20th century is an indication that, you know, that the Orange Book is an emergency revelation. There's a section in the last, and Paula, you quoted from it, I think it was, I can't remember when you quoted from it, recently on the air, paper 195. Secular totalitarianism, where it basically talks about how the secularist revolt was good initially against the authoritarianism of the medieval church, but then it went too far, and recently secularists have adopted a more militant attitude where they think that they don't need God, you know, and I guess my question, and then they talk about, you know, how more terrible destruction is yet to come and all these other things. They talk about how more human beings have been killed in the first third of the 20th century than in all of human history. Well, let me ask you something, Chris. Do you think that that's one of the reasons why the Orange Book was given to us at the time, that they knew that we were in this very secular kind of cycle in our history, and maybe a better question is this: do you think maybe one of the reasons why eugenics failed, and was so botched, is do you think it was basically run by people with a completely secular mindset?
Yeah, to a degree, true. Just step back with a little bit bigger perspective on that. I mean, the planetary administrators, you know, starting with the prince and his staff and going forward, they have wisdom, and they have God as their nucleus. You know, and that's really why they have enduring wisdom. When you study all of the evolution of civilization papers in the book, I've made this point as we've gone through them, in my Friday night study groups. You notice that they point out that there are indispensables to progressing civilization. And we're on the threshold, the midway point in that process of progressing civilization, where the four indispensables to this advanced half, if you will, of progressing civilization are true religion, true monogamy, prayer, and God consciousness. Now, the point they're trying to make is we are at a state of our evolution of civilization where unless we progressively begin to put God at the nucleus of all things, directly confronting militant secularism, which, like you were saying, it had its roots in the recognition that you needed to separate church and state, but it has now gone militant and wants to separate God and man.
Yes.
If you separate God and man, if you succeed in separating God and man, all falls. Because man does not hold anything. No matter how much, the ignorant secularist might think that he's self-actualizing and self-sustaining, nothing is. And you must, in order for us to move forward, and, eugenics is a great example. I mean, our understanding of genetics is rapidly moving forward. It's a knowledge that is the domain of advancing civilization, not of primitive civilization. Like back in the prince's staff days, the prince and his staff held that understanding in their minds and helped the ignorant primitives that didn't hold that. Well, here we are. We're not ignorant primitives in terms of civilization. We're, technologically and stuff, we're in a more advancing stage. We've got to have the whole package here. And the only way to have the whole package is to progressively bring God into the nucleus of all things, social, political, economic, everything.
You point out, and it's so true, that is what we were cut off from in the very beginning. That is what the rebellion did to us. It cut us off from that. And without that, that is the foundation of all of this other. It's like Jesus saying over and over again, seek first the kingdom of heaven and all things needful will be added. Seek first the spirit and the material concerns will follow. And, of course, God is the father of spirits. He is the first great source and center of all things and beings. Seek first that greatest reality.
Larry, how much time do we have left?
We have about 17 minutes, I think. We also
if anybody wants to give any last-minute calls in, please give us a call. Our number is 646-716-8158. That's 646.
We have we have a couple of people who have been on the line if you'd like to take another call. Okay, here we go, 720. You're on the air. Hello, 720.
Hello? You're on Blog Talk, 720.
Okay, 720 is out of here. Let's try 603. Hi, 603, you're on Blog Talk.
Hi, this is Lewis in New Hampshire.
Hey, Lewis.
I want to back a little bit in the conversation. I've been listening. This has been fascinating. I want to commend Albert, first of all, for his transcendent insight on how to deal with that New Ager, about recognizing her ideals and then trying to move the conversation along from there. I thought that was excellent. And in general, I want to commend Albert for his ministry. He's doing marvelous work out there. But relative to Albert's question about what can we do that's of a more practical nature to move this eugenic thing along, I want to share something with you all that I heard on the news maybe as long as 30 years ago, and it sort of perked me up. I was an early reader, even way back then, and there was a Texas legislator who proposed that those, you know, let's face it, we have a permanent, unproductive, burdensome welfare population in this country. And he was proposing that in order to keep giving your welfare checks, that they had to submit to not permanent and irreversible sterilization, but the women had to be on the patch, for example, the birth control patch. And I thought, I immediately saw that, God, such an insight is connected in a not-so-loose way with some of the thoughts put forth in the Urantia book. And I said to myself, God, I knew his proposal wouldn't stand a chance in hell of surviving, but I thought this might be the beginning of public thinking about such sorts of approaches. Any comments from you all?
Well, can I just comment one second? Because I think one reason it's hard for people to accept something like that is because they think it's too intrusive to force someone to be on the patch or whatever. But I think even something more fundamental than that, if we could just say, okay, look, you know, we're not going to subsidize certain things. We're not going to subsidize out-of-wedlock births. We're not going to subsidize... Yeah, there are certain things that we could just refuse to subsidize. You know, I think that might get a little more traction, possibly. I don't know. Go ahead, Chris.
Well, yeah, and just, you know, when you think about, I mean, both the caller's thoughts and yours, Andre, are, you know, have merit. But just reflect on the difficult precursor that's in play, you know, the initial set of assumptions that make it so difficult for those thoughts to be discussed and potentially actualized in some way. You know, we're still languishing under the sophistries of the Lucifer Rebellion, and that's the subtlest of the sophistries that he put forward. That's basically represented by the third principle in the Lucifer Manifesto. Is this notion that that somehow we're innately divine? That, you know, this thing, that this sophistry that feeds into our self-centeredness and pushes it towards self-righteousness. We have to be humble. And that was the point I was trying to make, you know, when you're thinking about, you know, in Light and Life, they're breaking it up into 5 to 10 groups and all that. You know, do we have the humility to admit to ourselves that all of us, you know, would be at the bottom of the lowest group that they're talking about there?
Oh, wow. No, I didn't think about that. Really?
No.
Well, that's interesting.
I mean, we are ignorant of, you know, of what... I mean, remember what they say. I mean, forget about Light and Life. If we were to be taken to a planet, a normal planet, that's in the dispensation of the bestowal sun, we would think we'd been transported to the heaven of our dreams.
But the other side of that is, if we were taken to that planet, and we stood there in that place as we are, just what you said, Chris, our imperfections would be so stark by comparison, we would feel like we've been plunked down absolutely naked, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
We were plunked down in that environment. We would feel absolutely naked in our inadequacies, and it would be more than obvious to us how on the bottom rung we were in that place, you know?
Yeah, right. I mean, once you get past the very primitive stages, when the planetary administrators are overseeing selective reproduction, those who they are managing are not rebelling against this management.
That's a good point. That's
the Alpheus twins knew full well that they were not Peter, James, or John.
Right.
You know, they had humility. They knew, you know, that they were not the ones that God created to step forward and preach to the crowds. You know, that was not their part of the supreme.
And they accepted it.
Right.
That's
we have to be humble about this so that we recognize, how are we going to approach this pragmatically so that I am a blessing to the future of mankind and not a curse biologically.
I think the book is clear in pointing out that, at least back in the Planetary Prince's days, human beings are incapable of making these selective decisions, and that's why it was up to Prince and continued on through the Adamic dispensation. And I don't think anybody, I'm not comfortable passing judgment on my fellows that way. I certainly do not want to do it. And yet, we are so reminded of the urgency of the situation. And it does say we should at least recognize the genetic subnormals that need disenfranchising here in terms of reproduction. Yes, this is a real tough question. And I think, Dr. Chris, you hit it on the head when you said we have to do it preconception. Obviously, when people are here, it behooves us to love, serve, and minister unselfishly to them. This is not a case for hating anybody, but you're right about it. It has to be addressed on a preconception level. It's a difficult can of worms here. I commend Andre for, again, bringing up controversial subject matter. This is what he's so good at. And I'm just happy to hear everything you people have to say.
Yeah, and I'll just
before we get off the air.
Okay. I was just going to add one little comment to that as well.
Okay.
But go ahead, Albert.
And then if you're directly on point with me, why don't you follow that up, and then I'll speak right after that briefly.
He was kind of alluding to that passage that's in paper 51. Where it says, the difficulty of executing such a radical program on Urantia consists in the absence of competent judges to pass upon the biologic fitness or unfitness of the individuals of your world races. Notwithstanding this obstacle, it seems that you ought to be able to agree upon the biologic disfellowshipping of your more markedly unfit, defective, degenerate, and antisocial stocks. The whole point is, once we have a little bit of humility, we recognize how ignorant we are. But we're not devoid of wisdom. Our wisdom may be small, but it's not zero.
Right.
We can at least start, with some of the really, definitive things and find some way that it's socially acceptable to approach these problems.
Well, I want to let Halbert talk, because we don't have much time left, but I want to, before you do, Halbert, I want to just say, that, that passage, when I think of that passage, there are a couple of things that come to mind. One of the things that's really important to remember is it says you ought to be able to agree upon. So there has to be some consensus before we do this kind of stuff. It's not like something that's going to just be imposed on us by some elite minority.
Right.
The other thing I think it's important, though, is, as I said before, we're already practicing eugenics. One example, the first thing that came to my mind when I thought about that passage was capital punishment. If you think about it, capital punishment is a form of eugenics because these people are not going to reproduce if they're dead. So, and capital, at least in America, it's supported by at least 60% or more of the American people.
Unless they've reproduced beforehand.
Well, sure, but what I'm saying is they can't add to their numbers is what I'm saying. So what I'm saying is, in America at least, it's supported by the majority. I don't know what it's like around the world, but, we have a pretty good – that's one place where we can start. I mean, I think if you were to say to the American people, let's limit the number of appeals. Let's make this process more – now we have DNA evidence. The possibility of a false conviction is not going to be as likely as it was in the – I mean, I don't think you'd get a lot of argument, even from people who would normally be opposed to eugenics. I don't think you'd get a lot of argument from people. So that's just one example.
I agree.
Go ahead, Halbert.
Thank you. I just want to pull together two concepts. One is the concept of having a true honoring of the fifth epical revelation. I use the word true in this wonderful way that Chris brought out earlier in the conversation about that being a cosmically integrated manner that is integrating spiritual aspects and physical aspects. And I want to put that idea together with an appreciation for how the world is currently operating regarding eugenics, which is that there's just a world full of people not uplifted by the Urantia revelation at all, and they are taking action. They are not waiting to act. They are not waiting to be uplifted by whatever before they take actions on these issues. And so I mention this because I think, again, as Urantia book readers, we want to stay often in the comfort zone of just the spiritual conversation and not fully integrating it into our daily lives. Like, what are we going to do with this Urantia revelation today regarding the issue of genetics? Other people are acting, and they're not waiting for us to get more spiritual or more enlightened or, you know, more developed in our thinking. And our thinking as Urantia book readers, I will assert, is typically enjoying quite an enhancement over the general population regarding these issues. And so in that sense, I encourage people that this is the time to be fully integrative, to be true to the revelation, to ask ourselves, as people in that small minority of those on the world who appreciate it as the epical revelation it claims to be, what can we do today beyond getting a better understanding of the text? And I want to really emphasize that. I'm not saying let's act and stop, you know, developing a better understanding. Both of these are ongoing processes. And as time speeds up, as our circumstances of today are getting so dynamic, it becomes increasingly important to bring into the balance the doingness of things, especially because our culture has been so much in our heads about this stuff, so much focusing on how it can uplift us personally and avoiding some of these outreach issues because they're challenging. So that's my final comment. Thank you very much for having this show. It was awesome. Thank
you. How much time do we have left, you guys?
4 minutes.
What?
Four.
4 minutes. Okay. Chris, why don't you close here for us a little bit? Maybe if you wanted to kind of leave people with anything. Well, actually, before we do that, Larry, do we have any more calls?
Nope. Looks like we're clear.
Okay. Chris, before you go, before we close, why don't you, if there's anything you'd like to say to the, you know, if you want listeners to walk away with anything, you know, of how to think about this issue of eugenics, what would be your closing thought?
I think Halbert had a number of good sentiments there, you know, too, for closing. But just again, in general, to stress, don't shy away from the difficult parts of the revelation. As you're reading the revelation, when you come across a passage that initially makes you feel comfortable, that's what you're looking for. Because, you know, you should know it's a revelation. You should know you can trust it. That many other experiences with it should have demonstrated that conclusively to you. So when you find those passages that that initially concern you or are disconcerting, don't shy away. Face them. And use your relationship with greater truth that the other parts of the revelation have allowed you to develop to engage that and see that part of the of your life experiences or that part of the world around you that you that you're having difficulty with it, being to see that in a new light, to let the revelation reform your understanding in that area, so that you can get past all of that initial ignorance that we all come into this world with. None of us are born innately divine. We have to reject that sophistry of Lucifer. We're born wholly ignorant. And by grace alone, you know, God gives us what we need to start. And then we have to challenge ourselves to constantly be sifting through what we think we know, discovering where it's still a childish thought. Reform it. Use the revelation to reform that area and become an adult. And we need to be adults to address the issue of eugenics. It is serious adult issues, you know. Little children can't confront it.
Each one of us has a capacity to understand the great truths of the Urantia book in our own way and through the filter of our own understanding and our own abilities. and we all come to it with a different skill set or mindset. But I think the best thing that any of us can do is, no matter where we find ourselves, no matter what sphere of influence we have, to hold up the truth of this great revelation as high as we can to our greatest understanding of them. And, you know, we've all studied it fervently for years and years and years and years and years. The best we can do is hold these truths up, no matter what conversation we're in, no matter who we find ourselves with, hold them up to our highest understanding and with the most dignity and love that we can. You know, we've avoided these topics simply because they're difficult, and they're difficult because people tend to misunderstand them. And you add to that centuries of the bad things that have happened on this planet, it makes that even worse. But we still have to hold these truths up because they're honest and they're logical, and they make sense. It's like parenthood. Is it a right? Is it a responsibility? Is it a privilege? We have to make basic assumptions about these things. I think it's a privilege. It can't be a right.
Take up that challenge to know more truth, and then let that truth shine forth. Put that truth into action in your life.
As much as possible.
As much as you can.
Yeah.
You guys, we are getting to the end here, so why don't we call it a day here? And thanks again, Chris, for having us on, for being on with us. And I'm trying to arrange a show next week about the whole issue of when does life begin, and we'll touch at least a little bit on the issue of abortion and its implications, that, you know, from a urantropic perspective. I don't know. I'm trying to get some guests on that topic, so we'll see what we can do for next week. In the meantime, thanks again, everybody, for listening, and it's been a pleasure, again, to do this show and to hopefully be of service to everybody here. So, with that
thanks,
said,
Chris.
We will let you guys go.
You're most welcome.
Thanks.
God bless.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Are we all out there?
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. If you would like more information about the Urantia Book, or if you just have comments or questions, please feel free to email us at cosmiccitizen@xnet.com. That's cosmiccitizen@xnet, the letter X, net.com. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.